Okay, it's about time for us to get started this afternoon. Glad to see everybody. Did everyone get a handout today? We've got a new one, Genesis chapter 31. It's just one chapter, but it still covers four pages the way we've got it laid out. So hopefully everybody's got one of those in front of them. That's what we'll be looking at today. We're going to take the next step in Jacob's life story, as it were. This is where he is going to separate from Laban. God has placed him in Laban's household and close proximity to this man for 20 years. And surely that was a time of God's chastising Jacob for his own greed and worldliness and willingness to exploit other people, because as we're going to have clarified for us again in the chapter today, Jacob meets his match, as it were, in Laban. He works with a man who is of his own nature, and God uses that to humble Jacob. And in fact, then next week, Lord willing, in chapter 32, we'll see the story that I think is illustrative of Jacob's conversion. And so we'll see where he really comes to trust in God. And I don't know that that is just one moment in time, but over a period of time, God has brought him to this kind of faith and confidence in the true and the living God. So let's start with prayer. We're going to pray specifically for Nick again today, for God's blessings on him. And then we'll get into our text this afternoon. Our God and Father in heaven, thank you so much for the blessing of this day and for the opportunity at this hour to open your words together. We are grateful for every part of Scripture, O God, and we're thankful for the book of Genesis and the way that it lays a foundation for our faith and for our worldview. We pray, O God, that we would be mindful in it of how you are revealed and your promises for your people. We're grateful for your faithfulness in the lives of your people, even when they are wayward and unfaithful, as Jacob certainly was during many years of his life. We do pray, O God, that you would bless us this afternoon, that your Spirit would guide us and help us, that we might rightly understand, rightly divide, and rightly apply your word. We ask your blessing on Nick, O Lord, that you would be pleased to grant him help in his condition, and that you would strengthen and bless him. And that there would be others, perhaps on our hearts and minds, O God, for whom we are praying continually. And we ask your blessing to be with them also, that you would meet each one according to their needs, and that you would use even our physical and emotional sorrows, O God, to strengthen us spiritually and to draw us closer to yourself. We thank you for this time and pray that you would fill our hearts and minds with a renewed awareness of your love and your greatness and your will for us. In Jesus' holy name we pray. Amen. All right, we'll read this chapter over a few parts. We'll start with the first page, the first paragraph, Genesis chapter 31. And he, Jacob, heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's hath he gotten all his glory, or all this glory. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. And Jehovah said unto Jacob, Return unto the land of thy fathers, and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. And Jacob sent, and called Rachel and Leah to the field unto his flock, and said unto them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not toward me as before, but the God of my father hath been with me. And ye know that with all my power I have served your father, and your father hath deceived me, and changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled shall be thy wages, then all the flock bear speckled. And if he said thus, the streaked shall be thy wages, then bear all the flock streaked. Thus God hath taken away the cattle or livestock of your father, and given them to me. And it came to pass at the time that the flocks conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the he-goats which leaped upon the flock were streaked, speckled, and grizzled. And the angel of God said unto me in the dream, Jacob. And I said, Here am I. And he said, Lift up now thine eyes and see. All the he-goats which leap upon the flock are streaked, speckled, and grizzled, for I have seen all that Laban doeth unto thee. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointed a pillar, where thou vowed a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy nativity. And Leah and Rachel answered and said unto him, Is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not accounted by him as foreigners? For he hath sold us, and hath also quite devoured our money. All the riches which God hath taken away from our fathers, or from our father, that is ours and our children's. Now then, whatsoever God hath said unto thee, do. All right, let's stop there for a minute. So this is, at the end of the 20 years, we saw that Jacob serves Laban the first 7 years for Rachel, but instead of receiving Rachel, he receives Leah, and then after a week, Rachel. And for that, he serves another 7 years, so that he has paid the full bride price for both of Laban's daughters. After that, Jacob is prepared to leave, a story we saw last week. And Laban, recognizing that he has prospered tremendously while Jacob has been serving him, offers to pay Jacob a wage in order to remain. And even in that, Laban tries to trick Jacob out of that which is rightfully due to him. He manipulates the situation for his own advantage. And yet Jacob, by God's providence, remains with Laban for another 6 years. And during that time, God continues to bless and build up Jacob and his family and make him, in his own right, a very powerful and wealthy person. Now, at this point in chapter 31, God appears to Jacob and reveals to him that it's time to leave. He calls him out of the land of his forefathers, out of the area where his family has settled, and calls him to go back to Canaan, back to the promised land, back to where Isaac and Esau are and where Abraham and Isaac have spent all of their lives. And so this is the land of promise. This is the place where Jacob is called to go. And what's interesting is that we see God taking a far more direct role and more explicit role in Jacob's life than what Jacob has been acknowledging up until now. God spoke to Jacob in Genesis chapter 28 when he first left his father's household. He appeared to him at Luz. You remember that Jacob renames the place Bethel. And God made a promise to Jacob that I'm going to take care of you and I'm going to bring you back safely. And Jacob says, well, if you do that, I'm going to serve you. Well, here God says, all right, it's time. I've taken care of you. I've blessed you. And now I'm going to bring you back. And God is asserting himself in Jacob's life in a far more direct manner than he has apparently over the last 20 years. Now, that doesn't mean that God has not been with Jacob. It doesn't mean that God has not been blessing Jacob, but it means that for a season, God has left Jacob on his own, so to speak. And Jacob has struggled. He has suffered. And yet, as he looks back over the last 20 years, he sees all that Laban has tried to do to hurt him, and he realizes that all that time, God has protected him. So this is a reminder that sometimes in our lives, we may not perceive the nearness of God. We may not perceive the power of God or the providence of God. And as I said before in this class, I'm convinced that we cannot read providence in the moment. We can't look at the tea leaves of providence and say, well, I see what God is doing here. No, you probably don't. Providence is only really appreciated in retrospect. We look back and we say, wow, look at what God has done. But for these 20 years, Jacob feels like he's working his fingers to the bone, and he is working for a man who is seeking at every turn to take advantage of Jacob and to enrich himself and to harm the man who is his son-in-law. And yet, looking back over the last 20 years, he sees God's faithfulness. He sees God's protection. He also sees that Laban's attitude has certainly turned for the worse. Laban, at first, was glad to have Jacob as a son-in-law, and he was especially glad to get 14 years of free slave labor out of Jacob. But over the last 6 years, since Laban began paying Jacob wages, the composition of Laban's own wealth has changed. And Jacob describes this to Leah and Rachel as he has them out in the field. He says, if your father said, I'm going to give you all the street animals, then suddenly all of the animals are having streaked babies. And Laban says, well, no, I meant the spotted animals. Well, suddenly, all of the flocks and the herds are bearing spotted babies. Who's doing that? God's doing that, right? Jacob's able to see that in retrospect. Laban's also able to see it, but he doesn't consider that to be a blessing from God. He considers that to be a curse. This is terrible. And his attitude toward Jacob has changed. So God tells Jacob, it's time to pack up and leave. I want you to go back to the land of your forefathers, the land that I have promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and to you. And so Jacob calls Rachel and Leah, verse 4, out into the field to meet with him privately. You don't want to have this conversation at home while Dad is just in the other room. And he explains to them both what God has revealed and the things that he himself has observed. Now, one of the things that I want you to notice is what he says in verse 6. Your father hath deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. Now, he's talking here not about the fact that God has made the last 20 years easy for Jacob. It hasn't been easy, and we'll see that even more clearly later in the chapter. But looking back, he can see that God has worked even the difficult circumstances of the last 20 years. He has worked all of that for good. And he's able to perceive God's protection in a way that he could not before. Jacob, his whole life, has been lived on the basis of his own resourcefulness. He's cunning, he's manipulative, he's deceitful. Since he came out of the womb, he has been grasping the heel of those in front of him, trying to pull them down to take their place. And he did it with Esau, he did it with his father, he tried to do it with Laban, and yet he says, God is the one who has protected me. Not my resourcefulness, not my wisdom, not my cunning, not my schemes. He calls his wives in and he says, you know what, I've prospered tremendously, and it's not because I'm a good businessman. I've prospered tremendously. It's not because I'm good at taking care of sheep and goats. I've prospered because God has blessed me. This is a more humble Jacob than we have ever seen before. God is finally getting through to Jacob. He is working on his heart. He is changing his mind. He is changing his orientation toward the Lord. Verse 9, he says, God hath taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. God did that. Now, I want you to remember that last week we looked at a passage that saw Jacob using superstitious breeding practices to try and gain an advantage over his father-in-law. You remember? He would take the rods, the sticks, and he would peel the bark and make them strike. And he'd put them out by the watering troughs when the animals would come and they would mate there. And this old superstitious idea that whatever they're looking at is going to affect their offspring, right? So maybe I can get some striped babies if they're looking at these striped poles. But Jacob thought that was within his power to control. Now he sees better. Now he looks back and he says, no, it wasn't the sticks at the watering trough. It was God. It wasn't my plan. It was God. He recognizes his prosperity was the blessing of the Lord. And in fact, that was confirmed to him, verse 11, in a dream. The angel of the Lord said unto me in a dream, Jacob, he said, lift up now thine eyes and see. All of the male goats which leap upon the flock are streaked, speckled, and grizzled. For I have seen all that Laban is doing unto thee. Now, it's not the case that all of the male goats, the stud animals, were streaked and speckled and spotted. But in the dream, God reveals to him that his hand is upon these flocks and herds. That he is providentially overseeing all of the mating that's going on here and the offspring that are being produced. He's the one who is taking away the livestock of Laban and giving them to Jacob. Now, how sobering does that have to be? I mean, Jacob, as Jim has reminded us a couple of times, Jacob's not a teenager at this point, right? He is a very mature man. He's lived a long life at this point already, and he's got a good bit more to go. He has worked like a dog for the last 20 years for Laban. He is a resourceful person. Surely, at this point in his life, at this point in his professional career, right, he would want to be able to stand up and say, look at what I have accomplished. You know, I could write a best-selling book on how to breed sheep and goats to produce all kinds of color variations, right? I'm going to write a training course so that everybody else can know how to make it big in livestock like I have. He gets to this point in his life and he says, you know, I've prospered tremendously, and what I'm realizing is that I didn't have anything to do with it. All of my strength and resourcefulness and wisdom and scheming, that God blessed me in spite of all of that. Was God pleased with that kind of manipulation and superstition? No. Did God take care of Jacob in spite of all of it?
Yes.
God was good to Jacob, even at a time in Jacob's life where he was not acknowledging it. Now, some of you may be able to look back on your life and see similar stories, similar circumstances, to say there was a time in my life where I didn't have much use for God. I didn't pay much attention to God. Oh, I knew that there was a God. I knew that he was there. I'd sometimes say a prayer. I might go to church. But I didn't really have much use for God. I was living in my own strength. And God was good to me, in spite of how stupid I was, in spite of how unfaithful, in spite of how I neglected him. And the reality is, looking back, I see now that all of the good things that I was able to accomplish were not because of my strength or resourcefulness at all. It was because of God, his goodness, and his blessing. Verse 13, the Lord said to Jacob in this dream, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you vowed a vow unto me. Now, get up and get out of this land and go back to the land of your birth. It's time. God is saying, Jacob, I have fulfilled what I promised you I would do. I have blessed you, and I have cared for you, and I have protected you. Now you listen to me. It's time for you to submit to my word. It's time for you to get up and go home. Now this is important because it's not as though God has been giving these kind of commands to Jacob for the last 20 years. He's kind of left Jacob to kind of do his own thing, live on his own. And God has waited and waited, and now he says, all right, enough of that. You've seen that your prosperity, you've seen that your advantage comes only from me. Now, submit to my word. Go back to your family. Go back to Canaan. And I will take care of you there. What do Rachel and Leah say? Verse 14, they answered and said unto him, is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? It's a rhetorical question. Obviously not. No more inheritance. There's no reason to stay here. We are accounted by him as foreigners, for he hath sold us and have also quite devoured our money. Now, this is sad, but Rachel and Leah know what kind of man their father is. They know what he is. They know that he's a greedy person. They know that he doesn't really care about them. They know that he cares only about himself and enriching himself. And they describe this whole marriage experience as Laban selling them off. I'm going to trade a daughter who is liable to eat me out of house and home anyway. She's not good for much, right? But I'm going to sell her and get 14 years of labor from this healthy, strong young man. They say, at this point, our father doesn't even look at us like we are his daughters. He treats us like foreigners in his own house. There's no reason for us to stay. Verse 16, all the riches which God hath taken away from our father, that is ours and our children's. Now then, whatsoever God hath said unto thee, do. Do it. Right? They are on board and they are ready to go. Now, here's the problem. Knowing what we know about Laban's character, how is Laban likely to react to this, right? Do you think that Jacob's going to be able to go into Laban's office and say, Dad, really enjoyed the last 20 years. It's been quite miserable. Thankful that it's over. Nonetheless, God has said it's time for me to move on. Hope you do well, right? You don't even have to give me a gold watch. I'll just go, right? I don't think that Laban's going to receive this news very well. And I think Jacob knows for a fact he won't. So let's pick up the reading in verse 17. Then Jacob rose up and set his sons and his wives upon the camels, and he carried away all his cattle and all his substance which he had gathered, the cattle of his getting, which he had gathered in Padan Aram, to go to Isaac his father unto the land of Canaan. Now Laban was gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the terephim that were her father's. And Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, in that he told him not that he had fled. So he fled with all that he had, and he rose up and passed over the river and set his face toward the mountain of Gilead. Let's pause there for a minute, make sure we understand. Jacob gathers everybody and everything up and begins to drive the cattle toward Canaan, drive these herds and flocks of sheep and goats toward Canaan, packs up his family and leaves while Laban is gone shearing sheep. And when it says he's gone shearing sheep, it doesn't mean that he's just in the backyard or that he's on the back 40. He's a couple or three days away at this time. And Jacob times his departure on purpose knowing how Laban is going to respond. Now, you could say this is another example of Jacob being deceitful or manipulative. Or you could simply say it's Jacob being strategic and wise. He knows that Laban is not going to take this sitting down. That Laban is going to do whatever he can to prevent Jacob leaving with all of this wealth that is rightly Jacob's, but that Laban is surely going to try and claim. So whether you see it as strategically wise or whether you see it as another example of his sinful manipulation, in either case, Jacob knows exactly what's coming. It says that Laban had gone to shear the sheep, and Jacob did not tell him what his plans were when he left. It also says in verse 19 that Rachel stole the teraphim that belonged to her father. She stole them. These do not belong to her. Teraphim are household idols. So they are little gods, right? We're not talking about large monument kind of statues. Little small idols that would be used to bless the home, representative of various deities. And they would be prayed toward and things of that nature. Now, what does that tell you about Laban? Does Laban know who Jehovah is? Yes. Does Laban acknowledge Jehovah? Yes. Is Laban's heart firmly fixed upon Jehovah alone? No. Is Laban's worship of Jehovah what God intends for it to be? No. What does it tell you about Jacob's family? His wives grew up in a household that practiced what we call syncretism. That is where we take true religion and false religion and we combine them or place them side by side. This, by the way, is very, very common, unfortunately. I see Christians that want to combine Christianity and Buddhism. Christianity and just worldliness. That's syncretism. God, yeah, absolutely. God is not pleased with that, folks. But Rachel grew up that way. And so when she leaves, she takes the gods that are important to her because she's prayed to them her whole life. Jim?
City crossed the Euphrates?
I'm sorry?
The city crossed the Euphrates yeah. when they left?
Yeah, that's what it says. I don't think that that's the right reading there. Yeah.
That's on the other side of Iraq.
Well, no, the Euphrates is a great big river, but yes, broadly speaking, yeah, it would be southern Iraq. He's up in Padan Aram, which is, as I understand it, more on the western side of the Euphrates. Yeah.
In the map in my Bible at home, it shows that he was actually between the Padan Aram is between the Tigris and the Euphrates.
Okay, could be.
And
could
be. He would have to cross the Euphrates to get down.
Okay, that could be. Maybe. All right. So, Jacob steals away in the night. Rachel takes the gods with him. That's about to be important. Verse 22. And it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob was fled. And he took his brethren with him and pursued after him 7 days' journey. And he overtook him in the mountain of Gilead. And God came to Laban the Syrian in a dream of the night and said unto him, take heed to thyself that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. And Laban came up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountain, and Laban with his brethren encamped in the mountain of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, what hast thou done, that thou hast stolen away unawares to me, and carried away my daughters as captives of the sword? Wherefore didst thou flee secretly and steal away from me, and didst not tell me that I might have sent thee away with mirth and with songs, with tabret and harp, and didst not suffer me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now hast thou done foolishly. It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. But the God of your father spake unto me yesternight, saying, take heed to thyself that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. And now, though thou wouldst needs be gone, because thou sore longed after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my gods? Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, lest thou shouldest take thy daughters from me by force. With whomsoever thou findest thy gods, he shall not live. Before our brethren discern thou what is thine with me, and take it to thee. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Alright, so Laban gets told 3 days after Jacob's left. That's why I say he's 2 or 3 days away at this point. It would have taken a messenger from his home a period of time to get to Laban to inform him of Jacob's departure. 2 to 3 days, because we would say maybe they don't immediately realize that Jacob has left. They travel 2 or 3 days. Laban learns about it 3 days after Jacob's own departure. He catches up with him in 7 days, though, because remember, Laban is not driving flocks and herds. He doesn't have 4 different wives with all of these children. He doesn't have as many servants. He's able to move a lot quicker, in other words. And the night before he catches up to Jacob, God speaks to him in a dream and says, "Be careful. Do not say anything to Jacob, good or bad. You are not allowed to touch him." Well, Laban doesn't touch him, but he yells at him, right? Comes up to Jacob, and this is just the most absurd melodrama that you'll ever read, right, at least in Genesis. Laban comes up, "What have you done that you have stolen away unawares to me?" You think Laban didn't understand why Jacob left in the middle of the night like this? He knew exactly why. And why have you carried away my daughters like captives of the sword? Are you kidding me? Seriously? As if Jacob has taken Leah and Rachel hostage, right? They want to go with their husband. They want to stay with their dad, who doesn't even treat them with any respect or love at home. Verse 27, "Why did you flee secretly and steal away from me, and you didn't tell me so that I might have sent you away with mirth and with songs and with music?" Are you kidding me? Like, that's how that was going to go. Laban was going to throw a going away party for Jacob and his family. Yeah, no, he's going to bury Jacob in the back 40 if he found out he was trying to leave. And then verse 29, "It is in the power of my hand to hurt you." Let me just make that clear, Jacob. Right now, I have the power to harm you. But the God of your father, notice how Laban distances himself from Jehovah there? Do you think that Laban is pleased that God spoke to him the night before and told him, "You cannot touch Jacob"? See, Laban knows Jehovah. He knows that he's the true God. He acknowledges him on some level. I don't think Laban is too happy with what Jehovah said. And so he says to Jacob, "The God of your father." He realizes that this is not the God of Jacob. And at this point, Laban's not willing to own him as his own God. He said, "He warned me last night that I'm not to speak to you either good or bad. Now, I understand that you want to go. I understand that you were homesick. But why have you stolen my gods?" Now, this is the part where Jacob says, "What are you talking about?" He says, "I left the way that I did because I knew how you'd react. I knew you were going to react this way, as a matter of fact. But as far as your gods are concerned, I don't know anything about that. You and your men search all of my stuff. You go look, and whatever you find among my things that actually belongs to you, you bring it out right here, and we will settle this right now. Anyone who is found with your God, that person will die." That's how convinced Jacob is that they don't have the idols. Little does he know that Rachel does, in fact, have them. Go to the next page, verse 33. "And Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tents of the 2 maidservants, but he found them not. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered into Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the teraphim and put them in the camel's saddle and sat upon them. And Laban felt about all the tent, but found them not. And she said to her father, 'Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise up before thee, for the manner of women is upon me.'" She's saying it's her time of the month, right? "And he searched, but found not the teraphim." Isn't it interesting? The first place he goes is Jacob's tent. The last place he goes is Rachel's tent. You think Rachel may be his favorite? You think maybe he assumed that surely my sweet little girl Rachel would not have stolen my gods? And yet by stealing his gods, do you think it tells you something about sweet little girl Rachel? Maybe Rachel's a little more like her father, right? She hides them. Puts him in the camel saddle, sits down on it, says, "Sorry, I can't get up, Dad. You know, please don't be offended." She's hiding the gods from Laban. You know, I wonder what would have happened if he found them. Because Jacob has already said, "Well, the person that took them will die." This is going to put both men in quite a pickle. Regardless, he doesn't find them. He doesn't know about it. And Jacob is ignorant as well, at least right now. Now, how do you think Jacob feels about this? If Laban comes up and he accuses Jacob of wrongdoing, of taking his daughters hostage, of trying to deceive Laban about his true intentions, of stealing his household gods, and Jacob, in his own defense, says, listen, I think it's self-evident why I left when I did, how I did, but I don't know what you're talking about with regard to these gods. You search anywhere you want. You won't find them. Do you think that Jacob really wanted Laban to paw through all of his stuff? I don't think so. I think that Jacob is pretty offended. First, that he would be accused of these kinds of things. And secondly, that Laban would then follow through on this and actually search all of the tents. Jacob does not trust Laban. Laban, quite obviously, does not trust Jacob. Their entire relationship is unfortunately built upon the deception and dishonesty that has characterized both men all of their lives to this point. Right? Look at verse 36. And Jacob was wroth, he's angry, berated Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? What is my sin that thou hast hotly pursued after me? Whereas thou hast felt about all my stuff, what hast thou found of all thy household stuff? Set it here before my brethren and thy brethren, that they may judge between us. These 20 years have I been with thee. Thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young. The rams of thy flocks have I not eaten. That which was torn of beasts I brought not unto thee. I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was. In the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from mine eyes. These 20 years have I been in thy house. I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters, and 6 years for thy flock, and thou hast changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now thou wouldst have sent me away empty. God hath seen mine affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked thee last. That's a great speech, by the way. Right? I don't know if this is like, you know, those of you who may have attended school, you know, and your youth and walked uphill both ways in the snow, barefoot, 7 miles. I don't know if there's any embellishment to Jacob's description here. One thing that we do learn as we study the historical background of the Bible, because shepherding is obviously an important part of the historical context of the Old Testament, one thing that we do learn is that the description that Jacob gives here is largely consistent. In fact, it's quite consistent with the historical practices of the day, that the shepherd who was out in the field was responsible for the lives, for the safety of those animals. This is why later David will describe in his youth as a shepherd that when a bear or a lion would come and take one of the sheep, David would go after the bear, or after the lion, and would fight it and get the sheep back. And you say, why in the world? You know, this is something that we have a hard time relating to, because in American society, you know, we're perfectly happy to write things off as a loss. You know, the parable that Jesus told about the 99 sheep and the one that was lost make no sense to us, because we'd say, hey, I've still got 99. That's okay, you know? I can bear the loss of one. That's not the ancient context of shepherding at all. The shepherd was personally responsible for every member of that flock. And if something happened to them, he had to either recover that sheep or bear the loss of it himself. This is why later the prophet Amos will use this imagery in describing the judgment that God was about to bring upon the house of Israel, the nation of Israel. And he says it will be like a shepherd recovering only 2 ears of a lamb. A shepherd going after that mountain lion, trying to get the sheep back and finding the lamb's already been eaten and all I've got are pieces to show my master. This is what happened to that one. Because the master would not be satisfied for you to simply say, well, one of them disappeared. Well, how do I know you didn't take it somewhere and eat it? How do I know you didn't take it somewhere and sell it? How do I know that you didn't keep it for yourself, right? The shepherd was responsible for every one of those sheep and goats. And this is what Jacob's life has been like. He says, for 20 years, I have worked, I have served, I have been faithful to you, and you have been nothing but unfaithful to me. I have lost sleep, I have borne heat and cold, I have suffered loss, and yet through it all, God has protected me. Now, we saw that Laban is holding Jehovah at arm's length in this conversation. Look at what Jacob says about God. Verse 42. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely you would have sent me away empty. God saw my affliction and my labor and rebuked you last night. He's not yet recognizing Jehovah as his own God. I think that comes in the next chapter. But do you see that he is recognizing God's power and providence and protection in his life in a way that, as we said a minute ago, he's never said anything like this before. Jacob has always been about Jacob. Jacob has always relied upon himself. And what he's saying to Laban is, I would not have survived the last 20 years, much less thrived, much less prospered, unless God had been taking care of me. The God of my father Abraham. And then, how does he describe him in the second case? The fear of Isaac. Now, this is being used as a description of God. Whom did Isaac fear? Not Abimelech. Not famine. Not dangers along the way. You know who Isaac feared? God. God. The God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac, Jacob says, is the God who has been with me and who has protected me and even now is protecting me from you. And that's why he rebuked you last night and will not allow you to harm me today. That's a magnificent speech, by the way. That is so good. Right? What have you found that belongs to you? Bring it out. Show it. And if there is nothing, you be quiet for a second and I'm going to talk. Right? It's a magnificent speech. Yes?
Does it say anywhere that God shows himself, his face? Or...
No. No, because God does not have a face. Right? God does not have a body. God is invisible and dwells in unapproachable light. Now, what does happen is God manifests himself sometimes in a human form. And I think that the scriptures would indicate that that is always, or almost always, the Son of God. A pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, right? And so there are people who will see God in that way. But God himself, properly speaking, doesn't have a body to see, right? The Son of God now has a body because he has been incarnated by the Virgin Mary, right? He has taken upon himself human flesh and a reasonable soul. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Verse 43. And Laban answered and said unto Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. What can I do this day unto these my daughters, or unto their children whom they have borne? And now come, let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee. And Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. And Jacob said unto his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap, and they did eat there by the heap. And Laban called it Jegar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, this heap is witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Galeed and Mizpah. For he said, Jehovah watch between me and thee when we are absent one from another. If thou shalt afflict my daughters, and if thou shalt take wives besides my daughters, no man is with us. See, God is witness between me and thee. And Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold the pillar, which I have set between me and thee. This heap be a witness, and the pillar be a witness, that I will not pass over this heap to thee, and that thou shalt not pass over this heap and this pillar unto me for harm. The God of Abraham, and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. And Jacob sware by the fear of his father Isaac, And Jacob offered a sacrifice in the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they did eat bread and tarried all night in the mountain. And early in the morning, Laban rose up and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned unto his place. All right, this is an important scene. It reinforces some things that we've already seen with regard to the making of covenants. Earlier in the book of Genesis, we've talked about the importance of covenant making and treaties and taking oaths of peace. That's what happens here between Laban and Jacob. And there are certain features of this covenant. For instance, there is a marker. There is a physical witness, a covenant sign of this promise. Just as we saw when God made covenant with Adam and Eve and with all creation, he put a sign of his word, a sign of his oath in the garden there in terms of the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. When he made covenant with Noah and all creation after the flood, what did he do? Put a sign in the sky, the rainbow, a sign of his oath, a sign of the covenant, right? We'll see this over and over in Genesis chapter 17. God gives to Abraham a physical sign of his promises, of the covenant, circumcision, right? And we'll continue to see this even in the New Testament where God gives to the church the signs of his covenant, baptism and the Lord's Supper, all right? Well, here, even though this is a treaty that is made between two men, God is not directly a party to it, although we'll see God is an important third party to the covenant. But even though these two men are the ones entering into this covenant, there is a covenant sign associated with it. And it's this pillar, this large rock that's set up, and then the heap of rocks that is either around or beside that pillar. And that pillar and heap are known as witness. Witness. This is a sign that is a witness between Laban and Jacob. It's the boundary marker, so to speak. Laban is going to remain on his side of the room. Jacob's going to remain on his side of the room. And they're not going to come together for harm. They are agreeing together that they will respect one another's rights and respective positions and places. And that they are not going to be at war, but that they will be at peace. Now, another important part of that covenant is that God is the third party to it. So I want you to think about the covenant that is made when a man and a woman are married. And I may have told this story in this class, I don't know, but a friend of mine told this story to me about one of his best friends who had gotten married, been married for 20 or more years, and called his friend up one day and said, I'm getting a divorce. And my friend said, I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, what in the world happened? Has there been adultery or abandonment or what's going on? He said, No, we just don't get along anymore, and we're going to hang it up. My friend was stunned. He said, you can't do that. And his friend said, what do you mean I can't do that? He said, well, I was at your wedding, and I remember you stood up in front of all of us. And you made a vow before God that you wouldn't do that. See, we don't think about it that way, do we? But that's the reality of making a covenant. So this covenant is between Jacob and Laban. But God is a third party witness to this. Who is going to see to it that the word is kept? God. Who is going to punish one of these men if he doesn't keep his word? God. Vows are not made to men. Vows are made to God. I didn't promise my wife till death do us part. I promised God till death do us part. I realize that sometimes divorces happen. And I believe that even biblically there are reasons for divorce to happen. In this case, that wasn't the situation at all. Just so you know, this is not fun anymore. This is not fun anymore. Do you understand what it means to take a vow before God? To make a promise before God? It's a serious thing. We in America do not think this way. We do not think covenantally. We think contractually. We think about making business arrangements, and then depending on the terms of the contract, we can just get out of the contract. We just walk away from it. You say, but you gave your word. You made a commitment. Yes, but there's a loophole here. I don't have to keep my word after all. Well, that may work in business. Let me tell you something. It doesn't work with regard to vows that you make to God. This is a serious thing. We need to recognize that God is the one who makes this covenant, who is binding this covenant together. He's the third party witness to it. And then the fourth part of this covenant that's important to see is what they did together next to the heap. What did they do? They didn't shake hands. They didn't dance. They ate. They ate a meal. If I were Jacob, I don't know that I would want to eat a meal with Laban right then.
No.
Based on what Laban says right before this, I'm quite sure that Laban didn't want to eat a meal with Jacob, right? That these guys are angry with each other. But Laban starts this out saying, those girls are mine. Those children, mine. Those flocks, mine. What is he doing? Jacob has just said, what did you find that belongs to you? Put it out here. Laban says, your wives, your children, your flocks, everything except the clothes on your back, and maybe those, it's all mine. He says, but what can I do about it? I can't do anything about it. These guys are not in a positive frame of mind toward one another. Why do they eat a meal? Because you do not eat a meal with your enemy. You only eat a meal with your friend. Now, that may not be true in American society today, but it is absolutely true in the ancient Near Eastern culture of this day. You recline at the table with a man who is your enemy. You've got a knife on the table between you. You don't do that. Eating was a symbol of peace. Eating was a sign that there was no hostility. I mean, we have restaurants. We eat in the same room with people that we don't even know. Right? You didn't do that in the ancient world. You didn't go to a restaurant. You spread the meal right there, or you ate it in your own tent or in your own home. This is a family affair. I don't eat with you if you're a stranger. I'm sorry. And I certainly don't if you're my enemy. But Jacob and Laban eat a meal here together. Why? It's a sign of the peace that they are committed to. Not the peace that they feel, not the peace that they desire, maybe, but the peace that they are committed to by covenant.
That's like the modern reception after the wedding.
That's exactly right. That's part of where we get this. You realize this. I mean, we walk down an aisle. We take vows before God. There are signs of the covenant, right? What have I got in my hand? Right? And we eat a meal. You see the pattern?
What if they don't take it before that?
What if they don't take it before that? What
no, you don't get married before God.
Oh, well, okay, so I would say that marriage is, by definition, an institution that God has created. So if somebody goes to the justice of the peace, they're still married before God. They may not acknowledge that. And certainly there are sometimes marriages, especially today, that God would not approve of or be pleased with. Doesn't change the reality of marriage as an institution created by God. Yeah. It may be regulated by the government, but it's not created by the government. Yeah. So, notice verse 53. This is Laban speaking. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. Remember, Nahor is Abraham's brother that Laban is descended from. And so he's recognizing there is a God that our forefathers had in common. There is a God that their father served, Terah, and that God judged between us. That's Jehovah. Jacob, by contrast, swore by the fear of his father Isaac. That's the same God, recognize. Right? It's not a different God. It's the same God. But notice again how he's described. He's not Jacob's God yet, although I think we're getting mighty close. But he's the God that my father feared. The God that my father serves. And then what does Jacob do? Verse 54. When you read this, your mouth needs to fall open. Because if you've been paying attention to Jacob's story up until now, this is so out of character, it's just unbelievable. Jacob offered a sacrifice. And you go, he did what? Jacob offered a sacrifice. It's not the kind of thing that Jacob does. Jacob is not a pious person. Jacob has been a worldly, greedy, dishonest man. What does Jacob come to realize in this chapter? Who provides for him? Who protects him? Who preserves him? And who deserves to be honored for that? Now, I'm going to put my cards on the table here, recognizing that there's a little bit of speculation. I think that what you've got in chapter 31 is Jacob coming to an humble recognition that Jehovah is the only true God, the source of his blessedness, and deserves to be worshipped as a result. I think what you have in the next chapter, chapter 32, is where God breaks Jacob and says, no, that's not enough. You also have to trust in me. You have to entrust yourself to me. You can't keep God at arm's length and throw him a bone every now and then. This is what some people do who call themselves Christians, right? They have their God box, and then they have their everything else box, right? You go to church on Sunday, we do the God thing, we say amen to the prayers, we try to stay awake in the sermon, we have patted God on the head, and we've said, thank you for blessing us, thank you for taking care of us, we just want you to know that we believe that you are there, and now back to business as usual. I think that what God does with Jacob is in chapter 31, he convinces him, I am the source of all of the good that you have ever known, and I deserve to be worshipped. And in chapter 32, he says, but that's not enough. You're going to have to trust yourself to me. But you'll have to come back next week.
Do you believe in God or do you believe God?
That's the difference. That's the difference, right? Jacob believes in God, and he is now moving to the point of worshiping God, but that is not saving trust. That is not saving faith. There are people who will worship God their whole lives and go to hell when they die.
Oh, please don't say that.
They will. Because worshiping God is not the same as trusting in him. Worshiping God is something that everyone who trusts in him will do. But worshiping God is not the same as trusting in him. You can go to church every day of your life and say the prayers, and sing the songs, and listen to the preaching, and say, I believe. Walk on and not entrust yourself to him. And we are saved.
Good is worship, man.
I'm sorry?
Good is worship.
Nothing. It's not good for anything at all.
So we don't need our churches.
No, I do think we need our churches. But what I'm saying is that a person who worships without trusting in God, it's vain worship. It's accomplishing nothing. I think we do need our churches, absolutely, because it's God's purpose that his people gather together as the church to worship. So the church is very important. The point is, the church is no good apart from faith in God, apart from real saving trust in Jesus Christ. Right? You might as well sleep in. And that's actually what the Bible says. Malachi chapter 1, God asks through the prophet, who among you is man enough to lock the doors of the temple so that my people will not come and kindle fire on my altar in vain? Or Paul says it this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. He says, when you come together to eat the Lord's Supper, you come together not for the better, but for the worse. What he's saying is, if you're going to worship in this way, you ought to just stay home. You might as well. God, you see, the gods of the pagans, they were appeased by worship. The God of heaven and earth is appeased only by the gracious sacrifice of his Son. And you only have the benefits of that sacrifice if you are trusting in him. So pagans, they could take a virgin, toss her into the volcano, and say, we're good for the next year. And that's the way some who profess to be Christians think of God. We go to church on Sunday, we toss our virgin into the volcano, and we're good for the rest of the week. But the only thing that will satisfy the true and the living God is the sacrifice of his Son. And the only way that the sacrifice of the Son covers you is if you believe in him. And that doesn't mean that you believe that he existed or that he is resurrected. It means that you trust yourself to him. And that's the difference. That's an important difference, right? So I think we're actually seeing that happen in Jacob's life. He's moving in the right direction. Praise God. But he doesn't yet fully trust the Lord. That's going to come in the next chapter. Okay.
Is this pillar that they created basically classified as an Ebenezer?